From Greenville to Lansford, Bloomsburg to Altoona, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Pennsylvania is an energy-producing state, but state government policies are preventing us from fully developing those resources. We talk solutions with State Senator Gene Yaw. A failure to extend the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act would result in a huge income tax increase for small businesses and working families. We get the latest on congressional maneuvering from Phil Kirpin of American Commitment. And our founding fathers began our nation's experiment with self-government. Now it is your turn to continue the journey. Emily Green from Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania, talks about it on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to State Senator Gene Yaw in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. In the grand Pennsylvania tradition of Groundhog Day, the issue of whether undated mail-in ballots should be counted has yet again been ruled on by a judge. This time, a federal judge has ruled they must be counted. This after the Pennsylvania Supreme Court currently has ruled they cannot be counted, but they have agreed to hear further arguments. Ultimately, the issue is bound for the U.S. Supreme Court. It seems the only judge unlikely to rule on the issue is Yankee slugger Aaron Judge. The Pennsylvania State Senate has approved legislation that would require prosecutors to notify Immigration and Customs Enforcement if a person charged with a crime is in the United States illegally. All Republicans and four Democrats voted for the measure, which, if enacted into law, would make Pennsylvania safer. The Pennsylvania Department of Labor and Industry has released its report for the month of February and finds the unemployment rate remained unchanged from January at 3.8%. That is below the national unemployment rate, which rose 0.1% in February to 4.1%. Over the past year, the number of jobs available was up 69,700, with gains in 8 of 11 sectors measured. Education and health services posted the largest job gains. The race for the Democratic nomination to be mayor of Pittsburgh is shaping up as the marquee battle of the 2025 primary election season. Incumbent Mayor Ed Gainey is facing a stiff challenge from Allegheny County Controller Corey O'Connor. A spate of newspaper articles in recent days has focused on turmoil within the Gainey administration, which has vacancies in critical posts and is struggling with rising crime and the inability to seat a permanent police chief. Gainey was elected 4 years ago as the progressive wing of the Democrat Party in Pittsburgh made inroads into elective offices. This year's battle pits the progressive and traditional wings of the party against each other. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Pennsylvania sits atop one of the largest natural gas plays in the world. We could produce enough energy to power the northeastern United States and export liquefied natural gas. But state policies and regulations instead have us facing the possibility of future power shortages. Here to discuss Pennsylvania's energy future is State Senator Gene Yaw. He is chairman of the Environmental Resources and Energy Committee in the state Senate. Senator, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Senator, as chairman of the Environmental Resources and Energy Committee, you set the agenda for the key issues that that committee is going to consider in this legislative session. You recently had a news conference to that end. Want to give us some of the highlights of the energy issues that you are concerned about this session?
Some of them are not more verbal type things, or appearances. For example, we think that it's very, very important to have an independent energy office in Pennsylvania. And what I'm saying by that is, if you recall, years ago, 10, 12 years ago, we established an independent fiscal office in Pennsylvania. There was a lot of comment at the time, well, you're just duplicating financial information, which everybody else does. But it was always done on a kind of a partisan basis, and we thought that what we needed was somebody independent to call balls and strikes down the middle for everybody. And we think that energy being so critical at this time and for Pennsylvania is an independent energy office to do the same thing is really critical to what we're doing. We have some other things that we're looking at. Energy choice is a big issue with us, and that by that we mean that no municipality or the government should not dictate what kind of an energy scenario that you put in your house, whether it's your heating and air conditioning is by electricity or gas or geothermal or whatever else. It should be the homeowner's choice or the developer's choice. We're also trying to address questions about solar arrays that are out there, and we have a major bill that would involve bonding of solar arrays. My goal is I don't want to see a landowner or farmer in particular, since farmland is being used for this, to get stuck 25 years from now with 100 acres of solar panels that they somehow need to get rid of, or the infrastructure. So those are just some of the things that we've already done. A bill that is called an abrogation of the RGGI. RGGI, if you remember, is the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative. That was something that Governor Wolf tried to put us in 2019, and it was determined by our courts that the governor did not have the authority to do that without legislative approval. So our courts have said that, and unfortunately, regulations are still part of the book by our abrogation bill that we passed in the Senate. We eliminate those, basically repeal those regulations. So those are just some of the things that we've already started working on. One of the big areas that is out there that we talk about constantly is the capacity of our electric grid. Our electric grid, unfortunately, we have not paid attention to it. We haven't been building the capacity that is needed, and it's going to be needed in the next 10 years. And it's going to be a huge issue for all of Pennsylvania and for the PJM electric grid, which covers 13 states plus the District of Columbia. So those are just some of the things, and I think that maybe you get the idea just from the magnitude of the issues that we've talked about. It really keeps us pretty busy.
You bring up RGGI, and we have talked about RGGI on this show many, many, many times over the last few years. The fact that RGGI is still somewhat hanging over the head of the energy industry, do you see that as being a problem and maybe contributing to the concern over whether we're going to have the generation capacity we need going forward?
Oh, no, you're absolutely right. I've had generators tell me flat out that we, as long as that RGGI is hanging over their head, which is basically about an $800 million tax, as long as that's hanging over their head, they are not going to invest one nickel in generation capacity in Pennsylvania. So that started in, as I said, Governor Wolf tried to put us in RGGI in 2019. Since 2019, we have not had a gas-fired or combined cycle power plant or a dispatchable power plant of any kind built in Pennsylvania. And that's pretty critical, because in the 10 years prior to that, we had about, I think the number is around a $14 billion investment in generation capacity in Pennsylvania.
We are talking with State Senator Gene Yaw. He represents the 23rd State Senate District and is chairman of the Environmental Resources and Energy Committee, and we are talking about energy here today. Another major component of energy here in the Commonwealth, Senator, is natural gas, and gas particularly in the Marcellus Shell region. What have you seen over the last few years in terms of development of that resource, and does your committee have efforts underway to sort of jumpstart it more now that we have a more friendly administration, a more energy-friendly administration in Washington?
Natural gas is, I think, the key, and everybody now looks at natural gas has done more to the environment, for the environment and lowering emissions, I think, than anything. My recollection is the emissions in PJM are the lowest that they've ever been. And in the United States, our emissions are, I think, as low as they've been since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. In Pennsylvania, we could do more. We have the capacity. We've got the natural resource. We need the infrastructure. We need more pipelines, which are problematic in a lot of people's mind. The capacity is there. We need more people to build the power plants here. We should have people lined up at our borders waiting to come here to do business. And like I said, we've got the capacity. We just need to build the infrastructure, and we need a friendly environment from the government and everybody else. And I'm just not sure right now we still don't have that.
It's interesting you would bring that up. Reason Magazine has an article up on their website talking about the fact that we have this sort of looming energy, particularly electrical generation shortage. And they talk about, Senator, the fact that you have all this energy available, natural gas resources in our country. Yet with the imposition of tariffs, Canada is exporting electricity to northern states, to New England states. It doesn't seem, does it, to make much sense that we're importing energy from another country, even Canada, but we're importing energy from Canada, and they're even importing energy from Russia, oil and natural gas from Russia, when here in Pennsylvania we have an abundant supply. How did things get so out of balance there?
It makes no sense whatsoever. We have the resources in Pennsylvania to provide natural gas to the New England states. And the biggest hang-up there is a pipeline through New York. Now, my understanding is that the president is going to reinvigorate that whole idea about a pipeline into New England, which is great. It'll be great for Pennsylvania. As far as importing power, we need power. There's no question about it. We have the capacity. The problem is we haven't been building. And here in Pennsylvania, there's a whole history of what we haven't done. We've been retiring plants, and we have not been replacing the type of power that we're retiring with a comparable type of power. And what I'm talking about is what's referred to as dispatchable power. That's the power that's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365. It doesn't matter whether it's night, day. It doesn't matter whether the wind's blowing or the sun's shining or anything. That's the type of power that we need. Wind, solar, those types of things are intermittent, and they're of limited duration. And the power that everybody is demanding is continuous power, not up and down or anything like that. We have not been building that dispatchable power for the past, pick a number of years, 5, 10 years. The flavor of the month has been, we're going to have all solar, and we're going to do all these things. We're going to have batteries. Well, maybe someday that might be true, but the problem is we don't have it now. There's no technology in the foreseeable future that would support that, and the only thing that we can rely on mainly is natural gas. It is the most prevalent fuel that we have to replace things and to do so with lower emissions. So all those things are here in Pennsylvania. We should be using them and doing them, but we haven't.
We have been talking with Gene Yaw, state senator from the 23rd District. That's in and around the Williamsport area. Senator, where can folks find you on the web? Because you brought up a lot of very interesting topics. Where can they find you?
SenatorGeneYaw.com.
State Senator Gene Yaw, Senator, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Congress continues to work on One Big Beautiful Reconciliation Bill, which would prevent a spike in income taxes for small businesses and working families. For more, we turn to Phil Kirpin of American Commitment. Phil, welcome back to Lincoln Radio Journal. Phil, we have the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act set to expire later this year. A lot of maneuvering going on relative to that. First of all, please catch us up. What has occurred so far in terms of efforts by the administration and by Congress to extend these tax cuts?
Well, we've got passage in the House of a budget resolution that has an instruction to the Tax Writing Ways and Means Committee that would extend substantially all of the expiring tax provisions, probably for something like 8 or 9 years. The Senate has done a budget resolution that has no tax provisions of any kind, and they kind of said they don't like the House version because they want permanence, but they don't want to do tax until later in the year. Or at least they originally said they don't want to do tax until later in the year, which is why they did that budget resolution with no tax provision. However, Senator Thune, the Republican leader in the Senate, has more recently, as of I think last week is when he came out and said this, said that the Senate thinking has changed and they now will do a budget with tax provisions in it. They're likely to take up the House passed budget and amend it to have what they're thinking of doing is actually different deficit reduction instructions for the House and Senate. So the House could still have their spending reduction target of $2 trillion, but the Senate version would essentially have no spending reduction target at all, and they would alter the tax language to allow for permanence and then send that back, and we'll see if the House could pass that. In any event, it's a long way of saying the House and the Senate are getting closer to being on the same page, but until they pass the same budget, identical concurrent budget in the House and Senate, they will not be able to write the actual tax cut bill. So that's still what they're working through.
Taking a look at the impact of these tax cuts and that occurred here during the first Trump administration, there's a lot of messaging from the left that these are tax cuts for the rich. When you look at it, it's really not the rich who are going to see, in effect, a big tax hike if this isn't extended, correct?
Well, taxes go up on everyone, and they will especially hit hard anyone with children because the child tax credit gets slashed in half from $2,000 per child to $1,000 per child. The standard deduction gets cut in half. The other big one is the small business tax. The top rate on small business income goes up from a rate of about 29% and change now because it's a 37% statutory rate, but there's a 20% exclusion, so it ends up at 29% and change. That's going to go up to over 40% if the expiration is allowed to take place. So small businesses will be especially hammered. And while non-corporate businesses are looking at this increase from 29% to 40% plus, corporate businesses, their 21% rate was actually enacted permanently, and that's been a pretty successful policy, but you still have this situation where non-corporate businesses are not only going to get hammered with a huge tax hike, but they are really going to be put at a huge competitive disadvantage as well. So those are kind of some of the major provisions. There's also we're already 3 years into the phase-out of the bonus depreciation provision, which is really big for business investment of all types of businesses. As of this year, they can only write off 40% of capital investment in the first year. The rest has to be subject to a long depreciation schedule. If they can get the tax cuts renewed and extended, we'll be back to 100% first-year write-off, which would be really good for business investment. So there's a lot of this that has nothing to do with tax cuts for the rich. And in fact, the percent of all income taxes that are paid by the top 1% went up under these tax cuts, which is to say that the rich have actually been paying more. They're paying more of their fair share under the tax cuts than they did before, both because of the way that it was distributed with the child credit and the standard deduction and other things, and also because the economy performed better and there was more income to be taxed. And so I think that criticism is particularly unfair. And Loma, one thing I would point out is when the Senate did that budget I mentioned with no tax provisions at all, literally changed nothing on taxes, the Democrats still did their same attacks of this is a giveaway to the billionaires and tax cuts for the rich. They said that even on a budget that had literally zero tax provisions of any kind. So they're going to say that no matter what. And I think that we need to be comfortable refuting it or not getting distracted by it.
We are talking with Bill Kirpin of American Commitment. We'll talk a bit about American Commitment in a few minutes. But let's take a look now at the economy. And Bill, last year during the presidential election, the economy was always either the top concern or at worst, the second most significant concern, along with illegal immigration. If nothing happens here, if Congress doesn't get its act together and the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act expires, what sort of impact is that going to have on the overall economy, inflation, and prices?
It'll be a major, major hit to the economy, something on the order of $4 to $5 trillion in higher taxes. And I think that we may be kind of on the front end of a recession already, and there's a lot of uncertainty with other things that are going on with the tariff threats and other sources of uncertainty just from the business cycle and other things. And the fact that we don't know what the tax rates are going to be next year and what the rules for investment are going to be next year, that means that there are a lot of companies that are already sitting on their hands. It's one of the contributors to the, sort of the economic uncertainty that we have right now. And if they could get it done early in the year, if they could get it to the president's desk and lift that uncertainty, that would be a huge plus for the economy and for rising incomes and job creation, because you'd see a lot more investment when you remove that uncertainty. If, on the other hand, they don't get it done, those higher rates are going to mean a lot less economic activity, and it would hit very, very hard, and not just for businesses, but also for individuals and families. As I mentioned, you slash the standard deduction in half, you slash the child credit in half. People will feel that directly, on top of a lot of people will be out of work or not have rising incomes just from the weaker economic environment. So it would be very bad if this tax hike actually happened. And even if they eventually cancel it at the last minute in late December, there's going to be a lot of economic damage in the meantime. That's why it's much better if they get this done sooner rather than later.
There are a lot of moving parts to this reconciliation bill, including President Trump on the campaign trail promised there would be no taxes on tips, overtime, and Social Security. Is Congress moving in that direction with these negotiations?
The chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, Jason Smith, has said that he thinks that within the parameters of the House-passed budget resolution, and remember, we don't know what the final concurrent budget resolution is going to look like exactly, but it does look like the Senate will kind of use the House one as a starting point. But the chairman of Ways and Means has said that he thinks he can get all of those new tax cuts in within the parameters of the House budget resolution, along with extending all of those expiring provisions. But they might only, the new ones might only be for a few years. And so we might only get 2 or 3 years of things like no tax on tips, overtime, and Social Security. And then, we'll see if they can be extended from there. So I'm reasonably optimistic that as this bill moves forward, we will see some iteration of those ideas, but they may be fairly temporary.
To get into the tall weeds here a little bit, we've talked about this as part of a reconciliation process. Can you explain what that process is? How does it differ from the normal, to the degree there is a normal way of doing budgeting in Congress?
This is a provision under the 1974 Budget Act that allows policies that that are principally budgetary in nature, which is to say the main purpose of the provisions is budgetary, they can be done through this process called reconciliation that's considered privileged in the Senate and protected from filibuster. And, there can, of course, be points of order where a senator will argue this is not principally budgetary, and then if the parliamentarian agrees, it would be subject to a point of order that would require 60 votes to overcome. But in recent years, this has become the principal process that's used for major changes in fiscal policy, including major tax policy changes, because it's become so difficult to get 60 votes in the Senate for anything that this is the process that they've leaned on, because it can be done with only 50 votes. It can't be filibustered. And so the 2017 tax bill used this reconciliation process. The Inflation Reduction Act, Green New Deal bill under Biden used this process. The so-called American Rescue Plan, which was the $2 trillion stimulus / inflation bomb at the beginning of the Biden presidency, also used this process. So this has become very common. I would say that it's become very common, at least since the Bush tax cuts, which used this process, and probably even going back further than that. And so just as sort of based on just the reality that it's not the 80s anymore. When Reagan did his tax cuts, I think he got 96 votes in the Senate, something like that. That might never happen for a tax cut again. And so fitting what they can within the Senate rules and the parameters of this reconciliation process is critical, because it means the Democrats can't filibuster it.
We have again been talking with Phil Kirpin, who is president of American Commitment. Phil, tell us a bit about American Commitment. Also, where can folks go to learn more about your organization?
We're a national free market advocacy group. We work really on all the fiscal, economic, and regulatory issues, and we try to focus people's attention and their efforts on the big fights that are on the margin, where more citizen engagement might make the difference in the outcome. And so we've got a lot of things in our action center on AmericanCommitment.org. And I would ask all of your listeners, if they've got just a minute, go to AmericanCommitment.org, click on the action center. You'll see the action that we've been talking about, urging Congress to cancel all of these pending tax hikes. And we've we've got a pre-written letter. You can just click to send it off to your senators and representative, or you can edit it however you want. Even if you disagree with me and want to write the total opposite, we'll make sure that it gets delivered for you. And that's all on AmericanCommitment.org.
Phil Kirpin of American Commitment. As always, Phil, thank you for taking time to be with us.
All right, Loman, have a good one.
Citizen participation is vital to the functioning of our representative republic. Emily Green from Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania explains how you can get involved on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
What made our founding fathers exceptional? The brave men who shaped the existence of our country, this great experiment, took one small step towards the direction of freedom, liberty, and prosperity. And their one small step, or rather, first step towards something bigger than themselves, our founding fathers created the most flourishing example of democracy in action. As we approach the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, which occurred right here in the Keystone State, Americans for Prosperity is calling on civic participants in every corner of our Commonwealth to join us as they take their first step in their activist journey. What could you accomplish when you take your first step towards protecting our country from the ever-growing threats to our values, which include individual liberty, limited government, the rule of law, free markets, fiscal responsibility, peace through strength, and human dignity? That's why Americans for Prosperity is encouraging you to take one small step towards bettering your community, your Commonwealth, and your country. We know that the threat of top-down government control limits our creativity, stifles our economic progress, and holds Pennsylvania back from achieving our fullest potential. Here in the Commonwealth, we still face the threat of energy policies that hold us back from sharing Pennsylvania's wealth of natural resources. In Pennsylvania, we still face regulatory barriers that prevent entrepreneurs from living their American dream. Even worse, these barriers to opportunity drive top talent out of Pennsylvania, allowing neighboring states to relish in the innovation and ideas that we should be enjoying right here in the Keystone State. We can and we must do better. But to achieve success, we must first take one small step. What will your first small step look like? To some, that could be walking into their state senator's office to voice a concern. To others, taking the first small step could mean organizing a phone bank where neighbors come together to rally support for a candidate for office. Or perhaps your first small step is simply attending an Americans for Prosperity legislative info session. However you choose to take your one small step, we are so glad you did. Learn more about how you can take your first step towards creating a better Pennsylvania. Our future is depending on you. Head to AmericansForProsperity.org, navigate to One Small Step, and sign your name to get involved. Again, that's AmericansForProsperity.org, navigate to One Small Step, and sign your name to get involved. This is Emily Green, State Director with Americans for Prosperity, Pennsylvania.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 30 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WDAD-AM in Indiana, WLLF-FM in Hermitage, along with WERG-FM at Gannon University in Erie, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, and the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.
Thank you.